Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction Predictions. Welcome to Fiction Predictions.
I'm Sam Haysham.
And I'm Nikolai Nikolov. The day has finally come. And I'm going to try to tackle one of the most popular dystopian novels ever written.
1984, you're right, man. That's a typo. Orwell's here now. He's living large. We had no names, man. No names.
But 1984 is also overused, especially in the world that we live in today. ...1984 has penetrated popular culture to such an extent that it's almost ubiquitous.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
There's dozens of films and TV shows and songs that experiment with the idea of Orwell's totalitarian society. Back in 2017, which now seems like a century ago, 1984 skyrocketed to number one on Amazon after what was an avalanche of false statements made by President Trump's administration about the size of the crowd that formed during his inauguration.
You did not answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts.
Oh, see, this is interesting because I remember when we were first talking about the podcast, and initially, I remember we weren't sure whether or not we were going to actually talk about 1984 because it almost feels, yeah, like you said, overused or a bit of a cliche in terms of this idea of fiction predicting real life. And at first, we were thinking maybe we should shy away from it, or not shy away from it, but just try and focus on lesser known examples. So I'm interested to see what your reasoning is for picking this to explore.
I initially had a very big problem with that because when I started looking into 1984 and looking at angles, there are so many articles out there that have a variation of the headline, you know, did 1984 predict the future? Or is it the right time to read 1984 now?
Right. So whereas other examples, like when you talked about the Panopticon, which I haven't read many articles about, I'd never heard of, this is completely the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Here's what we're going to do this episode. It's not like any other episodes that we've done so far.
Okay, brilliant.
So Orwell's 1984 turns 70 this year, and in light of that anniversary, I prepared a two-part episode for you, Sam. So in this first part, I'll dive into the novel itself, and I'll look at the roadmap that Orwell describes to see just how prescient the words in those pages are when it comes to today. For that, I've enlisted the help of Professor Gene Seaton, who's the director of the Orwell Foundation, and she's also a professor in media history here in the UK. And what I wanted to focus on is the place Orwell leaves in 1984 for something that very few people seem to recognize, and it's the place he reserves for hope, specifically for hope for a better future.
Brilliant. I mean, it feels like if there was ever any book or fictional example that we would stretch over two parts, 1984 is going to be the one, because like you said, there's been so much written about it, so many opinions that there's a lot of stuff to analyze.
It's one of these things that everybody knows about 1984 and everybody thinks they know what the book is about, but very few people actually know. When it comes to the nature of the totalitarian regime, very few people understand really which are the aspects that really apply to the day. So the second part of the episode, I'm going to interview three people. I'm interviewing...
You're putting me to shame. Like, I interviewed my friend Dave. Hi, Dave. I'm glad he's made it onto two podcasts already. But yeah, I interviewed him about the book he'd found down the charity shop or wherever it was. And you brought four people.
You set a very high standard with the Titan. I think really to do 1984 justice, we need voices of authority, because in a post-truth world, when we're talking about 1984, we really need to have people who know what they're talking about to actually really come to terms with which parts are real and which parts are just more allegorical.
Your name is Big Brother. You say that you are to me.
All right, Sam, are you ready to kick off this first part of the episode?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to need to bring Dave back in the future, aren't I?
Hi, Dave.
Your name is Big Brother.
Okay. Here we go. Our 1984 story starts with Professor Seaton here in London.
Yes, hi. How can I help?
She's a professor in media history.
Which means that I've spent most of my adult life in very precious things called archives, where humans have saved that which they think is important, and out of which, without which, we really do disappear. We don't know who we are or what we are without archives, so I'm very anxious about the state of archives.
Jean is also the director of the Orwell Foundation.
Okay.
Which offers prizes for writing and reporting.
But it also does great events like dramatizing and reading 1984 live, and generally tries to make everybody think hard about difficult things.
So 1984 live was the first time Orwell's book was read aloud cover to cover.
How could he communicate with the future?
It took exactly 11 hours and 13 minutes.
Either the future would resemble the present, in which case it would not listen to him, or it'd be different from it, and his predictions would be meaningless.
And it was read by 59 people, some of whom were great historians, some of whom you've never heard of, but every single one had played a key role in defending freedom of speech, some of whom, like Richard Blair, Orwell's adopted son, had a particular relationship to the text.
The telescreen received and transmitted simultaneously. Any sound that Winston made, above the level of a very low whisper, would be picked up by it. Moreover, so long as he remained within the field of vision, which the metal plaque commanded, he could be seen as well as heard.
And Orwell's grandson and great-grandson also read.
And a thick, quarto-sized book, with a red back and a marbled cover. For some reason, the telescreen in the living room was in an unusual position. Instead of being placed, as normal, in the end wall, where it could command the whole room, it was in the longer wall, opposite the window, where to one side of it there was a shallow alcove, which Winston was now sitting. Even with nothing written in it, it was a compromising possession.
Other participants included one of my favourite musicians, Billy Bragg.
It's a little chunk of history that they've forgotten to alter. It's a message from 100 years ago, if one knew how to read it.
As well as outstanding British directors like Ken Loach.
At all times, the party's in possession of absolute truth.
And Phyllida Lloyd, who directed Mamma Mia.
The arithmetical problems raised, for instance, by such a statement as 2 and 2 make 5 were beyond his intellectual grasp.
So we put together, every single speaker is there for a reason. And we did it in Senate House, which is a large 1930s, rather grand, modernist building.
And it also was used as the Ministry of Truth in the 1984 film.
So we did it in a very historically accurate and resonant place.
And they did this in June 2017, on the anniversary of 1984, just after Trump and Brexit. So it felt particularly prescient.
After Trump had been elected, it was a very sort of politically fragile moment. And of course, politics in all over Europe and possibly all over the world have become more fraught since then.
People suddenly seem to remember Orwell. They seem to remember 1984.
What's really unsettling about Orwell, though very useful if you happen to be running the Orwell Foundation, is his capacity to think very clearly into enduring contemporary experience. And there's something about Orwell, when he's writing 1984, being pressed by all of his experiences, all of the politics, all of the social understanding of authoritarianism and propaganda and the Second World War. But he's also pressed by his own vivid apprehension of his own lack of time. He's dying. That produces this not very long book in which every sentence counts.
So it's a book that reads like a warning for future generations, a handbook with like instructions for difficult times, let's say. And Jean says it's time to once again pay close attention to it.
You know, sales of Orwell rocketed after Trump was elected. I went to, you know, anywhere you go where there is oppression, Orwell becomes Samizdat.
Or the pirated distribution of literature banned by the state, and specifically in former socialist countries in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union.
He's always felt like a really good warning to us in what we had previously thought were relatively safe social democracies, but don't feel so safe now. He feels even better as a warning.
But like we said, 1984 was written 7 decades ago. So it was first and foremost a warning in terms of what Orwell saw developing in the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, the big isms of the 20th century. So what you're listening to right now is actually a recording of my dad, and he's talking about a letter he was asked to sign, distancing himself from his parents, who were deemed enemies of the people by the Bulgarian socialist regime. Today, we're reminded of 1984 once again because of the politically fragile moment we find ourselves in.
The party says the earth is flat.
There's the rise of far-right xenophobic political movements all across the world, but there's also the more complicated fragmentation of facts and truth in a digital age of social media.
Stupidity was as necessary as intelligence and as difficult to attain.
And one wonders whether the social media, in which people voluntarily give away constructs of themselves, and the algorithm that feel to me the most sinister, the algorithms which drive trivial things like, you know, offering you more music like you already like on Spotify, or offering you garden products because you have bought one, but more profoundly drive you into silos of like-minded opinion. And if you look at attitudes towards vaccination, I mean, never in my wildest dreams would I believe that people could turn against vaccination. But those algorithms maybe feel as if they don't feel separate from you. They just feel as if they're telling you more about the you that you are. So it's this, the commodification of the unintended gesture and the feedback of that into real action is very Orwellian. And the first thing Winston Smith does, the first transgressive thing he does, is buy himself a diary to compose himself.
The thing that he was about to do was to open a diary. It was not illegal, Nothing was illegal, since there was no longer any laws. But it was detected, it was reasonably certain that he'd be punished by death, or at least 25 years in a forced labour camp. To mark the paper was a decisive act, and a small, clumsy letters he wrote, April the 4th, 1984. For whom, it suddenly occurred to him, he wondered, was he writing a diary for the future, for the unborn? His mind hovered for a moment around the doubtful date on the page.
That notion of transgression is what I think is the most prescient part of Orwell's prediction of the future. Not the surveillance or the torture or the exploration into dictatorships.
Winston could see the whiskers and the yellow teeth. Again, the black panic took hold of him.
It's that sliver of hope that he offers through 1984. Something really very few people seem to notice. And it's perhaps because it's buried right at the end.
What I'd say about 1984 is nobody ever reads the last chapter. Nobody ever reads the last chapter because it's a very boring report of Comstock.
But that last chapter puts the entire book into perspective.
Oddly, makes it hopeful.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
So the last chapter is rather bureaucratic report on the narrative document you've just read by Winston Smith. And from that you learn that the Winston Smith narrative has survived. It survived in the archives. It actually lived. That's to say, Winston's testimony has not been obliterated. And that's an odd... Nobody ever reads that last chapter because it's quite boring. But actually, it's almost the most important one because it gives you a... It reframes everything you've read before into something that survived, not something that's disappeared.
History or narrative, they're preserved. The greatest horror in Orwell's dystopia is the destruction of meaning, a destruction that's carried out by hollowing out language. It's a horror we face today in a post-truth, alternative facts world.
What we are witnessing here is an added new chapter to George Orwell's 1984, where up is down and down is up, and sometimes now it happens in the same day.
And even though it's tempting to label almost everything around us as Orwellian.
But to say this was simply for the children's protection does seem kind of Orwellian when you consider what subsequently was done to them.
It's wise that we frame it according to Orwell's original warnings.
I think I'm going to go back and reread George Orwell. I mean, this kind of doublespeak, it makes no sense at all.
If Orwell teaches us anything, he teaches us to make subtle, important distinctions, using our language to name things accurately. So you have to reserve your words and use them sparingly. Otherwise, as Orwell says, you don't have the words to think with.
And so 1984 is kind of special. It's one of those really great books that survives, like Winston's diary, because it sort of anticipates the truth and stories that make us human.
So I think that novels from the past both tell you about the past, but they, really great ones, tell you human truth. Great poetry and great novels tell you terrible, uncomfortable things about yourself. And we all need more of that. And they tell you the pattern of good feelings. They offer you, and they take you into the minds of other people. I have always believed in the power of fiction to tell us truths that are of a different order.
He gazed up at the enormous face. 40 years it had taken him to learn what kind of smile was hidden beneath the dark mustache. Oh, cruel, needless misunderstanding. Oh, stubborn, self-willed exile from the loving breast. 2 gin-scented tears trickled down the side of his nose. But it was all right. Everything was all right. The struggle was finished. He had won the victory over himself. He loved Big Brother.
So, Sam, just to start this sort of final discussion of 1984 and what we discussed with Jean, I find it very striking that the thing that she found, I guess, the most important part, yet the part that remains the most hidden, is the sense of hope that is left in 1984. She talks about how, you know, the last chapter, the really boring sort of bureaucratic report that nobody reads, actually has hints that in a future world, Winston's diary and his sense of, you know, self is maintained,
right?
Is kept. And I think that's a reading of 1984 and a sense of foreshadowing that is rarely acknowledged. We always talk about Big Brother, surveillance, you know, newspeak and doublespeak and all these things, but we rarely talk about the human resilience in cases of, you know, totalitarian domination. And I just wanted to sort of bring this up and have your take a little bit.
Okay. So you're saying that often in, yeah, in all the talk of the sort of depressing side of 1984 and all the grim reflection that we see in contemporary society, all these examples, what's often lost in that is the kind of like glimmer of hope in this idea that Winston's narrative is not lost. Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And it is very true, isn't it? Like, it's no matter how many sort of unpleasant examples you see in different countries, or, you know, seemingly unpleasant to us as sort of outsiders looking at them from our lens, no matter how many examples there are always stories. Maybe they don't get as much attention, but there's always various narratives of hope and resistance. Although Orwell obviously predicted a lot of things to do with technology and to do with politics. Yeah, maybe that sort of message of human resistance is also a prediction in itself.
The thing that I always think about is, you know, stories that I hear from my parents of how things were under communism. The reason why it collapsed in 89 and in 91 in the Soviet Union in such a spectacularly unspectacular way, it just seemed to implode from the outside in, and people were dumbfounded yet somehow expected it, is because this entire system was hollow. Right. It was the only reason why it existed is the sheer force, physical force and ideational force that it constantly sort of pressed upon its people. But unlike the Orwellian narrative, which made the reader believe that everybody was sort of brainwashed.
2 + 2 = 5.
You know, the majority of the population was made docile by this totalitarian regime.
They can't get inside you, she had said, but they could get inside you.
Despite the incredible monstrosity that totalitarian regimes are, what I know for a fact, you know, even from my own research when I was doing my PhD, is that from the Soviet Union to Eastern European countries, Regular people manage to establish a sense of normality under that regime. And whether it's within their own house, where they sort of like sealed themselves off from the gaze of the regime, or whether for through certain uses of irony or barter, they found different ways to constantly criticize, negate, make fun of this regime, right? So whereas, you know, the fear in 1984 is that all human ingenuity, all human sort of independent thought, the desire for freedom is lost by the sheer force of the regime above. What I know for a fact is that the human spirit is much harder to break. And I think that's why it's so important that Jean stressed this idea of hope, right? Because whenever we bring up Orwellian in our contemporary society today, we always fear the worst. You know, when we talk about Trump, when we talk about China, when we talk about Russia, we fear the worst in terms of regressing back into these totalitarian regimes.
Right.
But we always underestimate the power, you know, of the human spirit, of the desire to be free.
Yeah, but it's like, yeah, exactly what you said, like whether it's, like you were saying, like whether it's someone in their own home creating a sense of normalcy, it's like Winston in 1984 with his diary, isn't it? Like he that's one of his acts of rebellion, is writing this diary and kind of, you know, keeping his own sort of, carving out his own private space in this chaos. And, you know, even in real world examples, like in China with Xi Jinping, there were these examples, for instance, of he was compared to Winnie the Pooh, the cartoon character, and it became almost a meme. And then China banned images of Winnie the Pooh, but there were still examples of people trying to kind of, yeah, trying to use images subtly, like on the internet or in photos, as a kind of form of rebellion. So I think you're definitely onto something with this idea of people carving out a kind of sense of normalcy in a private space, or using coded kind of language. But one thing I did want to ask you about that really stuck out to me, and is something I don't feel I know enough about. Back in the introduction, when you were saying your parents grew up in a totalitarian regime, you know, as a fairly ignorant person from the UK, I don't feel I know much about Bulgaria's history, and perhaps, you know, some people listening might not know. So what exactly was the situation for your parents?
The way that the Soviet-style totalitarian regimes are spread through Eastern Europe, in very simple terms, is that after the Second World War, the Red Army, the Russian Army, stayed in Eastern Europe, which was sort of supposed to be a buffer from any future attacks against the Soviet Union. And Bulgaria was sort of the closest to the Soviet Union, in terms of how, you know, how brutal the repression was in the beginning, because a lot of people were opposed to the sort of the newly enforced communist regime. There were, you know, a lot of people died. There were these so-called national courts where thousands of people, mostly from, you know, aristocratic or sort of supposedly bourgeois backgrounds, were sentenced to death. So in a matter of 20 years, you know, Bulgaria, which was predominantly rural, most people worked on, you know, in the agricultural sector. In a matter of 20 years, with collectivization, which means the nationalization of land, Bulgaria becomes predominantly urban. So most people work in industry and live in the city. And it's basically the entire country is transformed. And those that support the regime benefit significantly. So if you were, you know, born in a small village and you supported the regime, you would easily find a way to rise up in the ranks. But if you were against the regime, like my father's parents, you know, they were, my grandfather essentially was studying to be a doctor, and he had to sign a letter admitting that he supports the communist cause, and he refused to sign it and he was expelled. And then he and my grandma and my father, were, you know, they faced a knowing and persistent and very destructive kind of persecution, where like they wouldn't be allowed to move town. So when they were looking for jobs, they wouldn't be allowed to just go to Sofia. When they moved to Sofia, because they were a so-called enemy of the people, they wouldn't be able to find places to live, or they will be, you know, evicted and they'll have to find new places. When my father had to go and do his military service, he did it with like former, let's say, prisoners who went to jail before they had chance to go to the you know, to go and do their army service, or, you know, other sort of sons and daughters of enemies of the people. And, he, you know, when, for example, when he was at university, when he finished his university and he started working in the Ethnographic Institute, he could only become, you know, he could only get his PhD if he pledged allegiance to the party, which he never did.
Okay, so really, and, you know, like, obviously we've been talking about 1984, but that is, you know, the way Winston behaves in the book, that kind of seed of rebellion. And just, you know, even if you can find small or large ways to rebel, whatever it is, that is, that's, you know, very similar to what happened in your family.
And that's the thing that I alluded to in the beginning, is that 1984 as a bleak dystopian future of an all-powerful state is useless, because that's not what we face in real life. The dangers, the authoritarian impulses that we face are much more almost insidious. Invisible. Yeah, and banal, right? Because they're everywhere, and it's because we don't recognize how they limit our freedom and how they have impact on us that we allow them to grow and to fester. And it's that sense, that is the reason why I think the notion of hope is so important, because it's not a battle lost. It's not like the battle like we talked about in episode 4 against nature and the Titanic and the metaphor for the human feat to go beyond what we perhaps ought to.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I guess it kind of leads on to the next question, which is obviously the last question we normally ask in every podcast. And do we think 1984 is a good, or perhaps a better way to say it would be accurate, predictor based on your interview with Gene?
I think we should wait until next week. In that episode, I'll present three specific examples of the way that 1984 diagnoses different parts of the world that we live in today. I think for today, what's important to say is that Orwell is an incredibly insightful and intelligent human being who wanted to warn future generations of the dangers and atrocities that he witnessed himself, that he thought would reoccur again. And I think that is essentially what 1984 is. And I think that's why we need it today, when we're coming to terms with certain authoritarian impulses in different parts of the world. Okay, guys, that's it for week one. I'll be back next week with part two of 1984 in 2019. Thanks so much for tuning in, and thanks to Gene and to the Orwell Foundation.
Well, I really enjoyed it.
And thanks, Sam, for listening.
Anytime, that's what I'm here for.
Great, have a lovely day. Bye-bye.
Fiction predictions.
Fiction Predictions is a Mashable podcast created by Nikolai Nikolov and Sam Hasem. The theme song was composed by Kasberg. The artwork was designed by Bob Algarine, and this episode was edited by me.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi,
I am Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host
Niñas Bien podcast. We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.